our discussion. No. Okay. All right. Michael's going to just share for a minute. Okay. This morning we're coming back to our 1 Corinthians study. And again, it's really extensive. So we're going to transition as quickly as we can into it, except for giving just a little bit of an update. Bill Burns and I got back 2 weeks ago. Bill Burns and Steve just got back, so they've got reports of their experience, mainly in India. Michael got back Wednesday night from 3 weeks, which you don't want to do again, do you? That long. Older guys do 3 and 4, but you know, you got kids. But it was a terrific trip for Michael. His main task is to cluster all of our international partners together in 3 different places in India, and then all the Asian ones in Bangkok, and lay out their work on their 5-year plans. And but at any rate, he's got one story that you just got to kind of hear as a report here at the beginning, and then we'll quickly move into our discussions and attempt to cover a big portion of 1 Corinthians.
All right. Good to be home. I gotta give you a little context to this story. So this is at the end of my, I've been there for 3 weeks. I've had a few sleepless nights. I've had a few times of of despair. Like, man, is this really worth it? Man, is this really worth it? So I'm towards the tail end of my 3 weeks. Really kind of anxious to get home. But so that's kind of the mood I'm in. And y'all know me well enough to know that, like I'm just want to go home to the farm. So much simpler. So that's what's in my head. But I have 2-day meeting in Bangkok with all these partners. And it was a great meeting. It's great, great meetings with people from 10 different countries, Cambodia, Nepal, Myanmar, Mongolia, blah, blah. It was great. But I had to take a 1 a.m. flight out in order to get back to Chennai in order to have this meeting I'm going to tell you about. So I take this 1 a.m. flight. I arrive at my hotel at 5:30 a.m. and I have to get ready for this 12-hour day. It's going to be a Sunday in these villages at 7 a.m. So I get at 5:30. So I'm already kind of in an anxious mood, and then if you sleep for about an hour, you get more anxious. So I get into this car at 7 a.m. We drive an hour and a half to these slums, and I'm dressed like this. It's 90 degrees out, and I just told you what my attitude was and how much sleep I had. And so I go into these slums, and I'm kind of like, really? I'm tired, blah, blah, right? So I see, and just to give you the context more, there's in the slums, it's piles of trash, piles and piles of trash, and there's people living in the shadow of all these cities. So we travel an hour and a half, and we go to one place, and there's people living just, I have lots of pictures that I took that I could show you, but they're living and picking through this trash. So we go to this first place, first church that we go to, and all their sewage runs in a trench that's about 4 feet wide. In order to get into and it's about 6 feet deep probably, and there's only probably a couple feet of sewage, but there's animals in it and sloshing around and, you know, doing stuff. That's the context. It's 90 degrees. So you know what it smells like. You know what it feels like now, right? So I'm going into this building, and you got to walk over this. Again, I got these shoes on. I'm walking in over this bridge into this place. So I get in there, and there's 15 leaders, and I start hearing their testimony. And here's what they begin to say. This guy says, I've been a Hindu my entire life, and I saw a vision. I saw a vision of Jesus. 2 months later, I get approached by Ebi, this man sitting here, and he begins to tell me what it is to become a disciple. And he says, I have my entire life, I have given over to Christ and his teachings now. And since that point, I left my entire family. I left everything that I know, and I came here, and I have thus started 12 different churches. I have close to 1,000 people, Christians, that I've converted almost all of them with my people now, and they're all in my 12 churches. And we've been doing first principles for 5 years, and we're getting just about done. That was the first story I heard. So I'm feeling a little bit like, oh, okay. All right, maybe I got to adjust my attitude a little bit. So then I hear from the second guy. He's a Hindu. Nobody in his family. He's a first-generation Christian. And he said, what's happened is I've been leading this church, but my wife always uses Sundays for laundry because Sunday's a great day to do laundry. So they go out to the ocean, which is just a stone's throw away from where we were. We were right on the coast. And so I do laundry, and it never occurred to me that church was. I became a Christian, but I never knew church was a family thing until I went through Family of Families. By the way, they're saying all this in Tamil, so I don't understand a darn thing until it's translated. But and they say, I never understood anything until. About the church until I saw it was supposed to be a family of families, and so now I'm organizing all my churches to look like families. So, like, we're starting to eat together now. We don't have much to eat, but we're pulling people together, and we're eating. Everything's, like, around an evening meal. I'm like, what? Like, how they're picking up. Another guy said to me that his marriage, his wife was completely separated from his life work and all these things, and then he quotes, enjoying your relationship. So I met with these first group of 15 people, and they start quoting basically the principles or the titles of the first principles of the teachings. Isn't that amazing? So then I go to this next place, same scenario. We go 10 miles down the road, and I find out people. That first group, they're responsible that I met with, they're responsible for 300 churches. These are just pastors that came, 300 some churches. Nobody from Build, nobody from our team, nobody from had ever met any of these people. And I'm not bragging, I'm just saying that's the power of the teachings. None of us have ever been there. We don't, and quite frankly, we don't need to. But that's, again, the power of the teaching. So I go to this other place, and I find out some of these pastors have traveled 5 hours to come here. Five hours to come here, they kept saying, thank you, thank you, thank you to your church, thank you to your leaders, thank you for coming, thank you for all your work, thank you, because our lives in these villages are in slums are completely different, and they have meaning and purpose. This taxi driver, I went to a 3.5-hour church service in the same day, and it was all in Tamil again, so I can sing in Tamil now, but it was 2 hours of Tamil, and then they said to me right after the singing was over, they said, oh yeah, by the way, you have to preach, and I said, no, I'm not preaching, and Evie said to me, who's the translator and one of our leaders, he said, no, here's the deal. You can't say no. You can say no to the food all you want, Michael, and you can say no to their tea all you want, but you can't say no to preaching. I said no to all the Indian food a lot, but they said for preaching you have to do it. So anyway, this taxi driver comes up to me afterwards, and he said, I've been driving taxi for most of my life. I make about $1.50 a day total is what I make. And he said, I didn't know my life had any purpose and any meaning for the church. I thought church was something you attended. And he said, I am now learning that I have a role in God's plan. In God's plan, his church is his plan, and I have a role in it, and my family has a significant role in it, and we've committed ourselves to this church and this church being a family. So anyway, that is a 5 minute, 8 minute, whatever how long it's taken of my 12-hour day on that Sunday. I felt a little bit like repenting after the day was over. Because there was nowhere to go to the bathroom. There was just, you know, there it is. You just do what you need to do. So, but anyway, that was my Sunday a week ago. So there you go.
Thanks, Michael. The the part of the taxi driver story that you didn't mention was the fact that he didn't think that driving taxi for $1.50 a day had any value until he began to tie it in with life work and began to understand that that gives him a platform, you know, for ministry every day with everybody under the sun. I assume in a rickshaw, auto rickshaw, I imagine. He had that regular taxi. This morning is going to be a little intense in the sense that we cover a lot of ground. We're going to take it in big hunks, so I don't think you'll find it boring, but you're going to have to realize that, and you'll have the material available in booklet form in the future as well, so don't try to get everything down. Try to get the big idea or the big picture. Now, you've all got a discussion guide in front of you, and I'm going to have you discuss the last section of 1 Corinthians on the Lord's Supper, 11:27-34. I'm not even going to take any time for those of you that are either new or visitors to set much of a context other than the beginning of our time. We take a few questions that drive us into some of the main issues of the passage that we're going to be looking at. This case, the section of Corinthians we're going to be looking at, that primes the pump and gets your mind going and discussion moving, and then a set of discussion questions that you can use this evening in your churches to be able to follow up. Now, we're going to, your questions, well, let's look at your passage first that's on your sheet. He's confronted them on a problem, because there's divisions when they're gathered together as the Lord's Supper. Now, communion, to most of us, in terms of how we've been raised in different denominational traditions, is a little wafer, a cup, a time for some personal reflection in a short period of time at the end of a service. The Lord's Supper was central and foundational to everything that the churches did as they gathered, and it was the key to how unity was built within these house churches in such a way that they multiplied across the empire for almost 300 years and turned the entire empire upside down. The Lord's Supper was central and key to their identity and unity that the Spirit used to produce that kind of power within those churches for multiplication. But they're having problems in the Corinthian church, and that they're fighting, lots of divisions within the church. But when they come together, those divisions are vivid in their assembled meetings and vivid in their Lord's Supper. So he's telling them again what the Lord's Supper is supposed to be. It's a family of families meal that sits at the foundation of the gathering together of an individual church or the churches collectively, when they gathered collectively. It was a memorial remembering Christ, but specifically that his blood was a symbol of the new covenant that he'd set up. So it wasn't some mystical experience with Christ that you got as an individual, but it was collective and all designed with the view of beginning to produce a common footing of everyone on the new covenant. And so he says, so when you get together, the rich aren't supposed to eat ahead of time. There's supposed to be a tremendous visual picture of unity at the foundation. He said, and then he tells them, so they got to correct this problem and the divisions the way they're going at it. So the last section, he says, it follows from this that anyone who eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the blood, body and blood of the Lord. Everyone should test themselves. That's how you should eat the bread and drink the cup. You see, if you eat and drink without recognizing the body. Now, what does that mean? If you eat and drink without recognizing the body. Well, in certain high church traditions, that means trying to envision the body of Christ physically coming alive in your presence. But he's talking here about the body of Christ, of which Christ is the head, made up of believers in these churches. If you eat and drink without recognizing the body, you eat and drink judgment on yourself. That's why several of you are weak and sick and some have died. So, whoa, this is so important to the foundation and unity of these churches that God's brought judgment on some of them that's cost them their lives because of eating unworthily and not recognizing the body. But if we learned how to judge ourselves, we should not incur judgment. But when we are judged by the Lord, we are punished so that we won't be condemned along with the world. So, my brothers and sisters, when you come together to eat, treat one another as honored guests by waiting for each other. If anyone is hungry, they should eat at home so that you don't come together and find yourselves facing judgment. I will put the other matters in order when I come. So the questions that you're going to be discussing, and again, just in a short time, so I'll jump right into it. What was the central purpose of the Lord's Supper in the Corinthian churches as shaped by Paul? What did it mean for the Corinthian churches to participate in the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner? What specifically did it mean to eat and drink without recognizing his body? And how did the Lord's Supper lay a bedrock of unity in the gathering of the churches at Corinth? So go at this. Grab any one of the questions, and we'll take about 10 minutes for that discussion. Then we'll put this in context, and we'll work through a big picture of the gathering of the church in 1 Corinthians 11 through 14. Inside the church. And what was the conflict that Paul was trying to correct? What did it mean in this context to eat in an unworthy manner? Now, you really needed all three sections of 1 Corinthians 11, not just this last one, but what was the conflict? What did it mean to eat in an unworthy manner? Somebody jump right into that question. Raise your hand so Tim can get you the mic. That's the particular question I really want to focus on, but what did it mean to eat in an unworthy manner? Somebody summarize that. I'm not going to wait very long. I'm going to pick somebody. If Marvin, you want to take a stab at it? Say that.
Discipline?
Explain that. What do you mean?
Eating like in an unworthy manner. Means in which, you know, like, hey, if I'm just sitting at the table just gobbling down things, you know, if I'm just sitting there gobbling down things, people are kind of looking like,
okay, you're right. Part of the issue is a certain kind of discipline. They weren't focused on the purpose of the meeting. They were focused on gobbling down food rather than staying focused. So that starts us on the right foundation to the answer. Who wants to build on that? Oh.
One of the things that kind of stood out is that there's this sense when you're talking about being guilty of the body and blood of the Lord, or without recognizing the body. There's the God's created order, both in heaven and on earth, that is represented in the Lord's Supper, in the coming together of the people of faith. And it's an ancient tradition preceding the Lord's Supper, going back to the Seder Supper, in essence, God's people coming around the table and remembering what he's done for them. And I think there's a certain reverence to it, but there's also an understanding that there's a oneness, that there's a community. And what the Corinthians were doing is, like Marvin's saying, there's these people binging because they're hungry. They get there ahead of time and they eat, and it's not in an orderly fashion. Other people are drinking, and other people arrive late and maybe aren't well employed, or they're slaves and they don't have anything, and all the food's gone by that time. How is that a oneness? How is that a representation of the fullness of life that Christ provides? And in essence, what's being done is something that God has ordained as a time of reverence and remembrance and reflection is being perverted into something that he doesn't want his name associated with, and then follows the judgment of God.
Good, good. That picks up several other elements, Scott. The specific social context, if you remember from our building through 1 Corinthians up to this particular point, is that there was sort of an existing social strata, almost a class kind of system that existed, and not many were from that top end. And a majority would either have been slaves or freedmen, but having some obligation to the benefactors of people in that more noble class. And so as a result, some that would host banquets like this, you'll see this as we go along, would host banquets like this, would come early, eat separately with the quality food, and a kind of a keeping of that class system going on within the church. And so the divisions piled up, as we've been seeing going through Corinthians, and it all becomes visible when they assemble together. And as they begin to assemble and start this meal, you can see that people are being viewed as not having much significance. You'll pick it up in the phrases. Let's go. There's so much to do on this, but that both those get us started. Thanks, Marvin and Scott, for that. This theology of unity that's been unfolding in the book to this particular time that Paul built into his churches, Paul's theology of unity, was central to why the churches multiplied and multiplied and eventually turned the world upside down. But today, our Western churches know nothing of this unity, which is one of the main reasons why Christianity is impotent today in the West. Because we take what would be visible as strikingly different than the world around us and completely destroy it. Conflict, as we've seen in the book, is established of unestablished churches is inevitable. Converts are coming from every corner of society, different ages, different backgrounds, different cultures, different social classes. There are bound to be different views on about everything. Yet Christ churches are supposed to be one-minded and one family. And we have an example of all of these divisions in the Corinthian churches. In the two sections of 1 Corinthians, last week and this week, in these two sections, we learned an enormous amount about what it takes to build this kind of one-mindedness, what it means to think through the principles that are embedded in the apostolic teaching, and to deal with unique cultural conflicts that plague churches in every generation and culture. This is really, really foundational stuff to establishing churches. 3 weeks ago, we officially began our extensive series in the Corinthian correspondence, and it's important in filling out our understanding of how Paul laid foundations of the gospel for unity in his churches. And we'll see this unfold in we're seeing this unfold in 1 Corinthians and how he built unity in a whole network of churches in 2 Corinthians. We looked at Corinthians 1-6 to see how Paul's laid the foundation for dealing with disunity by returning to the gospel, and now we're looking at the divisions. Last week, we saw in the major section from 7 through 11 that there were divisions in their community, in their churches, in their church community. Divisions in marriage, divisions in social status and lifestyle, divisions in men and women's roles. This morning, we're looking at, again, three types of divisions in their community gatherings. Divisions at the Lord's Supper, divisions in the order of gifts, and division in the actual meeting itself. And these are laid out for, these slides are available online, I mean, in our on our website together with the presentation that I'm giving. So I won't take time to look at that right now. This is book four in our series. Again, that has six sessions. It's laid out just like the first principles. Book five will be the 2 Corinthians, and we'll finish that on the other side of finishing 1 Corinthians, obviously. And this is the Corinthian letters. Book four is the fourth one in this series of six. Now, again, there's quite a bit of background, and I'm going to read three or four quotes, again, out of Dunn today. But the background, you have to understand. All the clues are in the text, so you can get all the basic ideas and the interpretation I've given you out of the text itself. But there's been massive research the last 40 years on the Greco-Roman times and in a quest for what is called the quest for the historical church, particularly since denominationalism in the Western church is fragmented and in serious, fast decline, whereas there's massive growth of the gospel in Latin America, Africa, and Indian, Southeast Asia. The background centers around, in this particular text, Jared Thiessen, The Social Setting of Pauline Christianity, Essays on Corinth, and one of the main texts in this quest for the historical church is by Dunn. Both of these are non-evangelical works, but phenomenal, phenomenal research pieces. Beginning from Jerusalem, Volume 2. And I'm going to be quoting heavily from that in this section. Now, in our message and in our first session, we worked on coming up with the intention statement for Paul's letters collectively, 1st, 2nd Corinthians, which actually covers all four letters. This 1st Corinthians is the second letter. 2nd Corinthians is the fourth letter in this series of correspondence that we have from the Corinthians. But the main intent we're focusing on right now is just 1st Corinthians. And the purpose of the letter is to deal with the internal divisions rooted in differing social statuses fragmenting the Corinthian churches, with the view that the Corinthian churches, with the view they be fully participating with him in the progress of the gospel. And he reviews the gospel in a foundational way first, and then he addresses the factions in their community and in their community gathering. And he'll be appealing to the future resurrection in chapter 15, where he finishes 1 Corinthians. And by the way, chapter 15 appears just happens to appear when I get back from this trip on Easter Sunday, which is a great time to be going after the resurrection chapter. I'll be, I leave tomorrow morning. I'll be in four countries across the 3 weeks doing what Michael was describing. I'll be in Myanmar and Indonesia first, then Myanmar, then China, and then in Bangladesh. So there's warnings on four of those countries right now, so you might keep the whole team in prayer on that. This morning, going into that statement, we're focusing on their community gatherings. I'm going to skip ahead on this and get right to the divisions. What we did last week in those, we wound up with a set of principles out of those four chapters where on when there are divisions in married, those who are married, those who are single and engaged, widows, slaves, and looked at the strong and weak and the divisions that were there, and looked at this order of men and women within the church as a family of families as well. Now we turn our attention to the divisions in their community gatherings, the Lord's Supper, the order of gifts, and the meeting itself. Now, so you get the big picture. I'm taking this in three pieces. Chapter 11, which is the Lord's Supper, chapter 12, verse 1 through the end of 13, which is the whole issue of the divisions of the gifts, and the last one is the chapter 14, which is when they're having their official meeting after the supper that they had together. Just so you got the context here, when you had meetings like this where the churches gathered together, you would have a meal and the Lord's Supper first. Then you would retire back to about a two-hour period where it was an open interaction that was going on with teaching and the validation of that in discussion and community together. So you were actually part of about a four-hour meeting on the average. Now, what I'm going to do is, on one or two slides, just give you his basic argument. You got to go back and study this on your own and see that the argument's consistent. And then I'm going to pull it back around to showing a couple of the key passages that validate this and why it's significant, and it'll produce a whole when we're done. So we'll move pretty fast. Paul's argument is this: when you gather together in one larger meeting as a church of churches, what do you mean a church of churches? Well, all through the cities, where you can see this very early on in Romans chapter 16, for example, all the churches that were planted and gathered within a city were pretty much small house churches. The average across the empire would be about 15 adults. But the church of Corinth was made up of a number of these spread throughout the city. And they would gather together as a whole periodically. We don't know how often that was. Some texts, like Jude, calls it a love feast, where the church of churches gathered together. And I'll give you the clue of why this is the case in one of the passages here. But when you gather together as one larger meeting, as a church of churches, wait for one another before beginning, treating those who have nothing as equal members. At the heart of the meal is the Lord's Supper. Heart of the meeting, that should say, is the Lord's Supper. Remembering Jesus' sacrifice as the basis of the new covenant, making us all on equal footing in the gospel. Examine yourself, he says, as you gather, making sure you recognize the body, and particularly, that is, treat everyone as an honored guest, especially those who have nothing. Now, that's the simple argument. That's really all he's saying. But in the midst of that, remember, he dips into the well of the teaching, the didache, the gospel and the teaching of Christ, which Paul and the apostles delivered to the churches. And when he dips into it, he comes back out with that essence of that teaching and addresses the specific conflict that is here. Now, just listen to these verses. I gave you the quick summary, and listen to these sections. What I have to talk to you about now is not a matter for praise. Now, in the future sections, I'm just going to read a couple small portions on this argument, but I want you to see this one because it's so foundational. So I put 17, the Lord's Supper one here as a whole. What I have to talk to you about now isn't a matter for praise. When you meet together, you make things worse, not better. What I mean is this: to begin with, I hear that when you come together in the assembly, there are divisions among you. And I believe it, at least partly. There are bound to be groupings among you. That's how the genuine ones among you will stand out, I suppose. So when you gather together into one meeting, very significant phrase, when you as churches gather together in one meeting. Because the context of 1 Corinthians 14, you'll see, is a larger meeting. It's not all of those elements. He's not describing a small meeting in the context of an individual church, house church. Although all the elements would be there, we know from, again, the New Testament and from what we've been able to also study during that time. It isn't the Lord's Supper that you eat. Everyone who brings their own food to eat, and one, everyone brings their own food to eat, read that wrong, and one person goes hungry and another gets drunk. Haven't you got houses to eat and drink in? Or do you have to despise God's assembly and shame those who have nothing? So the issue is you're gathering together in one meeting. Some are wealthy. It's a few we know. And they actually are the ones who, these things have to be sponsored. And so the benefactors would be using their, in many cases, these meetings would be in a larger home of a benefactor that could accommodate in a courtyard in the center a larger group, or a hall that would be rented during that time. And but those who were wealthy and would sponsor that would eat first, and produce a the whole division produced a shame on those who had nothing. And you can see how people would be thinking, well, it's what they're getting is better than, you know, than their normal life situation, and they're not in our situation. So it just, it created, there was a dishonoring of those who had nothing and came later, which means they were not also of the leisure caste, so probably many of them had to work later than they wanted. They would come in, straggle in. Sundays was not a day off. There were no day offs for people that would be in the slaves or the freedmen kind of category. Now he dips into the well of here's the teaching. He says, this you see is what I received from the Lord and handed on to you. So here is the didache. Here's the teaching. To hand it on is, again, that term he uses again and again for an authoritative passing down of the teaching that he received. And that is that on the night and when the Lord was betrayed, he took bread. Ah, that's a clue. We should understand what Jesus did in John 13 in the upper room supper. On the night when the Lord Jesus was betrayed, he took bread and gave thanks and broke it and said, this is my body, for it is for you. Do this as a memorial of me. He did the same with the cup after supper and said, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Whenever you drink it, do this as a memorial of me. And whenever you eat the bread and drink the cup, you are announcing the Lord's death until he comes. Announcing is the word for proclaiming. It's the word for, again, kerygma. It's the proclamation of the gospel story. So when you gather together and you practice this memorial, you're proclaiming the gospel. You're telling the gospel story at that particular point. And the point is not some mystical experiencing of Christ on an individual basis, but the new covenant, the cup is in this memorial symbolic, to remind you of Christ's death, which brought about the new covenant. And the new covenant allows all of us to be part of God's family on the basis of what Christ did, not on the basis of our knowledge, our gifts, our special abilities, our social status, or anything like that. And then he finishes by saying, it follows that anyone who eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and blood of the Lord. Everyone should test themselves. That's how you should eat the bread and drink the cup. You see, if you eat or drink without recognizing the body, in other words, it's one body, we're all under one new covenant, we're all equal, the social status doesn't matter when you get into the community of faith. Everything changes, everything's evened out, everything levels at that point. And if we carry those caste systems, that's one of the hard things about establishing the church in India, in any culture, but we experience in India, is there are rigid caste systems. And the churches are still built around those caste systems. And so it loses its power as far as a reflection of a totally different kind of community when God's building a community within his plan. But there are several of you, you drink, eat and drink judgment on yourself. That's why several of you are weak and sick and a number have died. This is pretty serious. In other words, if you use the community of faith to flaunt your social status or your money, what happened to Ananias and Sapphira? It's pretty serious territory to be in. But if we learn to judge ourselves, we would not incur judgment. But when we are judged by the Lord, we are punished so that we will not be condemned along with the world. So, my brothers and sisters, when you come together to eat, treat one another as honored guests by waiting for each other. If anyone is hungry, they should eat at home so they don't come together and find yourselves facing judgment. I will put other matters in order when I come. Now, he's interested in things being put in order in the chaos and the divisions of this community. And you'll see this order thing right at the very end of 1 Corinthians 14 when we get there. So the significance or the implications are this. The Lord's Supper set the foundation and tone for the community-wide gathering. It was a great unity builder for the Corinthian churches when they gathered. It was not intended to be an individualistic, mystical way of experiencing Jesus, but a community-wide culture set by churches of grasping the concrete plan of Jesus for his disciples, the New Covenant. The New Covenant was a basic call to love one another as he loved us. So if you go, and Dunn captures this beautifully. His section is just so full of insight when he deals with this, Corinthians 11 through 14. He says, the other central position Paul obviously attributed to the sharing of the body and blood of Christ as the key elements of the shared meal, spanning the whole meal, giving the meal its sacramental character. It was the bonding effect of that shared meal which Paul sought to maintain, the bonding of Christ with the other participants. This was the real identifying factor and boundary marker of the meal, beginning with the bread and finishing with the cup. Not so much the meal itself, or even the bread and wine as such, but the experience of their sharing in a meal, in the bread and the wine, in their shared devotion to one Lord, in a mutual concern for one another. Can you imagine what's lost in our Western practice of the Eucharist, where everything is reduced down to a little cup and a little piece of bread and some kind of mantra or some kind of little experience that we do where we pause as a totally individualistic experience on the other side of a formal meeting and church service that is set up totally different than what the early church was set up on? Just totally obliterate the whole foundation of unity in a network of churches. Now, Jesus' inauguration of the Lord's Supper is very insightful in 13:34 to 37. I'm giving you a new commandment, which is the heart of that new covenant. It is this: love one another. Just as I have loved you, so you must love one another. This is how everybody will know that you are my disciples, if you have one for another. It's proclaiming that we're his disciples, but the bedrock is love of one another through the inauguration of the Lord's Supper. That's what Jesus said the main point was. And it's the new covenant in his blood is what he said. So it's a concrete foundation for the community as a whole, but the community gathering. Now, Paul, you remember, said, Paul will build on this unity in 1 Corinthians 12. Remember the main point in 11:29, if you eat and drink without recognizing the body. He will build on that now. So now we go into 12 and 13, and we'll catch those entire two chapters in one quick sweep, essentially. Paul's basic argument is there are a variety of gifts and services and activity. Together they make up a single unified whole, what he calls the body of Christ, with Christ being the head. Everyone, no matter who they are, the wealthy, the noble, the slaves, the freedmen, all gathered together, everyone has been given gifts and is an important part of the whole. As we are assembled, we need to go out of our way to honor those who are weak, both value them and acknowledge their contributions. This doesn't mean that there isn't proper recognition given to priority of gifts that lead and shape the community gatherings. Because he'll say at the end, well, there is an order in the sense, first apostles, second prophets, remember that. But what he's doing is laying the unity in the oneness of this community life and at the heart of this community gathering by his instructions. The most important element of the gathering together is visible love for one another, not the recognition or visibility of exercising spiritual gifts. Although that's an important thing that we're to pursue as, you know, we're gathered. And this is why he sticks 1 Corinthians 13, which is the love chapter, in there. Because this is what love looks like in your gathered community. It's not just an abstract set of verses, as N.T. Wright would say, like pearls strung together on a necklace that you can use for 3 points in a sermon on love. But it's in there to show what love looks like in its expression in a community that's built on this kind of foundation, which the world can't create. The world cannot create this. This is really cool stuff. The key is to understand the logic of in understanding the logic of this passage is that it builds on the Lord's Supper argument. No, he says, and I'll just read a couple little sections here, the parts of the body which seem to be weaker and are all the more necessary. And we give much greater honor to the parts of the body we recognize more, we reckon more dishonorable. In fact, God has made the body a single organized whole. He has given greater honor to the lesser parts. So the greater honor that takes place in that meeting is the acknowledgement of the lesser parts in a way that's what seals the whole. That's what makes the proclamation powerful. That's what's different than what the world can create. Phenomenal stuff. It's not say, well, the lesser parts, let's, you know, make them feel good and tell them that their parts are more valuable. And no, he said, this is a real meeting. There's apostles and prophets. What we're talking about here is those that don't have much to contribute that bring in. Everything's leveled when we're together as communities, and you need to recognize that God has given everybody significant contribution to make, but part of the contribution in this community and the honor that is given to them lights up the whole thing for everybody to see Jesus in real life, not some mystical out-of-body experience that we all create around a wafer. The key to understanding his logic in this chapter builds on the previous Lord's Supper argument. For we were all baptized, he says, and these are quotes out of the Corinthians 12 and 13 here. For we were all baptized into one body by one Spirit, whether Jews or Greeks, whether slaves or free, we're all given to one Spirit to drink. No, the parts of the body which seem weaker and are more necessary, and we give much greater honor to the parts of the body we recognize as more dishonorable. In fact, God has made the body a single organized whole. He has given greater honor to the lesser parts. Now, you're going to have to follow this argument, and this is the idea that sweeps across 12 to 14, because 12 to 14 is one unit. At the beginning, he says, now, about things relating to the Spirit's work, about spiritual things, my brothers and sisters, I don't want you to remain ignorant. You know that when you were still pagans, you were led off, carried away again and again after speechless idols. So I want to make it clear to you that nobody who is speaking by God's Spirit ever says Jesus is cursed, and nobody can say Jesus is Lord except by the Holy Spirit. So in other words, he's saying that in the past you were following idols. They were speechless. There was nothing to it. But you gather together in these ceremonies and just create ecstatic experiences and go nuts over these ecstatic experiences. But there's no content. He's laying the foundation for the fact that we're starting with Jesus as Lord, the gospel. And when you're gathered together, what we're not supposed to idealize is wordless, ecstatic experiences. But there's to be substance in that prophetic communication. So it sets the foundation for everything that follows. And again, Dunn does a beautiful job. Having dealt with the issues reported to him, Paul returns to the question raised by the Corinthians, what they evidently referred to as, pneumatika, I can't remember that particular word. Spiritual things is how he translates it. But Paul preferred to speak of it as charismata, what has been freely and graciously given, so he calls them gifts. That's the word for charis, the word for grace gifts as grace, grace that's been given. The distinction is probably indicative for the former evidently encouraged to focus on the experience of the gift, on the experience of inspiration, as an end in itself, whereas the latter focuses on the outcome of the inspiration, on the gracious effect of the gift on others, and whether or not that distinction can be pushed all the way, it certainly sums up the major thrust of both Paul's critique of the Corinthian worship and his evaluation of the gifts experienced in the Christian assembly. He goes on and says, the problem is signaled at once. Paul reminds his audience that when you were Gentiles, you used to be carried away by idols that were incapable of speech. Despite the questioning of some, the likelihood is that Paul recalls here at least some prominent Christians, experiences of ecstatic rapture in their former religious experience. While the wording itself, carried away to dumb idols, is open to interpretation, Paul's subsequent characteristic of the Corinthians is that they're zealots for the spirits. That is, in the context, presumably eager for experiences of inspiration. And his warning of the danger of so surrendering to the experience of speaking in tongues, which is the whole argument he's dealing with in 14, has given to any outsider the impression that we're out of our mind and have lost control of ourselves. Almost certainly carries with it the implication of 12:2, which refers to disapprovingly to such experiences in the Corinthian past. Now, you can go back and look at that quote. It's really, really full. But what I'm really after here is that Paul is really saying that if you have a worship that's devoid of substance and you're just going after the experience and recreating that experience, we're going to tie this in with some of our experiences in India at the very end, where you have all of these experiences and there's no substance that develops within the churches in what's called global Pentecostalism, even though I have great respect for global Pentecostalism. At the same time, that mindless experience kind of thing that takes place is something that is, we would call it syncretism. In other words, it's what they experienced in their own religion and they move it forward, and now it's dominated the worship service. And by the way, even though we don't, many of us as evangelicals don't have high church experience of the Eucharist in where you're trying to recreate the experience, we create the whole idea of worship. Very, very different than what took place here in the early church. And many times it's a mindless experience where we're trying to get an ecstatic experience. Totally the wrong way to think about worship. Now, the basic understanding of gifts, he says there's varieties of types of gifts, but the same Spirit, varieties of service, but the same Lord, varieties of different types of activity, but the same God who operates in all. In fact, I love this because one way of describing that is the same God who activates the gifts. So he gives them and distributes them, and then he turns them on, and they come alive inside of us, and together build a whole. Let me explain, and I wish we had time to go through this whole argument, but I just dip into it on a couple of these. Just as the body is one and has many members, all the members of the body, though they are many, are one body, so also is the Messiah. For we were baptized into one body by one Spirit, whether Jews or Greeks, whether slave or free, we were all given one Spirit to drink. He's still dealing with the same problem. We're all in the same body. We've all been baptized into it. We're all one. We're all given gifts. There's no reason. The social structure and status and classes goes out the window when we gather together as believers. This is a whole new community. It's different than what the real world is. By the way, we saw last week, he says, don't try to just change the real world and make it the church. You can't do that. But live in it and shine. All the work laid of being one body, valuing one another and showing honor to the less visible gifts after all the work of this, I should say, implying those who are poor and had nothing. Why does he go this direction at the end of the chapter? So he talks all through here about being one body. Everybody's important. It all fits together. There's no distinctions of social class or anything like this when you gather together. Okay, so he builds that whole argument. So what does he do at the end of chapter 12 when he's setting up chapter 14. And we're first going to look at the love excursus that takes place in 13 before 14. But at the end here, he's setting up 14. 13 needs to be interpreted in light of the context of the community-wide gatherings and of the social strata tensions that permeated the Lord's Supper and elevating the visible spiritual gifts, the visible spiritual gifts, especially speaking in tongues. While there are obvious, more important, and highly visible gifts that were more prominent, community-wide love for one another at the gathering should be the most visible thing. That's probably almost the most important phrase of the whole message, and that is that the most visible thing, which is why the Lord's Supper is foundational at the beginning, it's why you greet one another with the holy kiss, it's why the whole meal is put together in that way, because it's supposed to be the most visible thing. This is a community that operates, a society of believers that operates with a different set of rules. Not rules, but... So then he does 1 Corinthians 13:1-7. If I speak in human languages or even those of angels, in other words, if I do have these tongues and as well as they turn them into ecstatic experiences, but do not have love, I become a clanging gong or else a clashing cymbal. And I should have prophetic gifts and know all mysteries and all knowledge too, have faith to move mountains, but have no love, I am nothing. If I give all my possessions to the poor and for pride's sake my body, my very body, and do not have love, it's useless to me. Love is great-hearted, love is kind, knows no jealousy, makes no fuss, is not puffed up, no shameless ways, does not force its rightful claim, doesn't rage or bear a grudge, doesn't cheer at the harm of others, rejoices rather in the truth. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Now, what is the argument here? There is a way everyone should be treated in the community-wide gatherings. That's the context. This is embedded in the conversation of the community-wide gatherings. It starts with the beginning of the night with the Lord's Supper, and then we retire into 1 Corinthians 14, where you have the open meeting, where revelation and prophets and apostles are actively leading, and the Spirit is working through individual members. While the gifts are very important to the gathering, love must be visible. Everyone needs to be treated with love, patience, respect, caring, and not inferior in any way. And evidently there were problems that he refers to, like elevating those with the ecstatic gifts, treating those with lesser gifting, or the poor, less educated, and lower class with disdain, pride in their own gifts for those who were particularly knowledgeable, and the jealousy that took place between cliques, which makes sense out of why he chose the characteristics he did in first to emphasize of love in 1 Corinthians 13. Now Paul returns directly to dealing with the divisions of their community-wide gatherings. In chapter 14, which is our last chapter, he says at the beginning, pursue love and long for spiritual gifts, especially that you may prophesy. 1 Corinthians 14:1. That sets up the rest of his argument on this gathering. The divisions of the churches gathered, which at times even caused chaos, were from the use of the ecstatic gifts, especially speaking in tongues. Now, did I forget to put that? Yeah, at the end of, at the end of 12 is when, after all this, there's no distinctions, everybody's equal. He says, now, there is an order, first apostles, second prophets, third teachers, and last he lists of those visible gifts as speaking in tongues, which even though he's, I'll leave it right there. Understanding the meeting structure can be recreated from the text of 11:17 to 14:40 as all addressing divisions of the gathering churches. But it also becomes clear when one understands the meeting format of the social gatherings in the Greco-Roman world. There were two phases. First was a large ceremonial meal, followed by retiring to the meeting itself, characterized by entertainment, oratory speeches, and dialogue around the business of the association. That second meeting usually being around 2 hours. This was a common practice through all different kinds of associations in all the key cities in the Roman Empire at that time. So they gathered together for a meal, probably took a couple of hours as people were, and It was symbolic of the unity that was there, and there was a genuine fellowship and visible love and the equality of caring and respect for one another, etc. And then second, after that, was another retiring to a meeting where sometimes there was entertainment, there were oratory speeches, dialogue, and the unity and ideas of the association were worked on together. And this is the meeting that Paul's describing in 11 through 14. Paul's basic argument is this. He is addressing the larger gathering of the churches in Corinth, not individual churches and homes. That's that clue. You can see it many ways, but that's that clue of saying when you're gathered together as one. Prophecy is more important than tongues in the assembly meeting because everyone can understand what's being said and the church will be built up. Now, if you were reading through this carefully, you would see that they've elevated tongues to the top of everything and the ecstatic experience that goes with it, as well as oratory speaking prophetically I'll just leave that there. Tongues, someone speaking in a language they don't know, is a sign for unbelievers hearing that message and believing as a result. Do not speak in tongues in the gathering, he said, unless there is someone to interpret for everyone else, so the church can be built up, and then only two or three per meeting. So he had this bigger meeting, he restricts it, he knows that there are going to be non-believers there, he knows that that the Spirit can work in that fashion, some of them have even taken that gift and their own spiritual experience that's come out of it has been formed into an idea of private prayer, but this is dominating everything. The prayers, he says, okay, slow it down, only two or three per meeting, and only do it if someone is to interpret, because obviously the non-believer hearing it in their own language will understand it, but the church won't be built up. So how in the world is the church going to be built up, the community built up by the gathering, if it's all dominated by this? Especially if a people are motivated of elevating themselves. Do not speak in tongues in the gathering unless there is someone to interpret for everyone else so the church can be built up and only two or three per meeting. Evidently, this may happen if unbelievers are present, but if everyone speaks in tongues with no interpreter, the church meeting will not build up the church, and unbelievers will think you're crazy. He says that. Go back and read it. When Paul says he speaks in tongues more than them all, he probably means that because of his role in taking the gospel to the Gentile, God spoke in languages and dialects many times through him, but tongues were not meant for personal edification. And he says, I would rather speak five prophetic words and build up the church than 1,000 words in an unknown tongue in a large church meeting. That's the essence of his argument. Oh, there's more. Evidently, ones who had this gift could pray for others in another language. I think what happened here is that one of the ways, and we see this in these grassroots movements taking place in India, where the gospel has busted into the Muslim world, oftentimes by dreams of Jesus appearing to key leaders. He busts into many of the other cultures through tongues and the communication of that. So those kind of manifestations are there. And evidently, some people used it for prayer that God would communicate to a person that they knew in that language. And had the ability to practice it in a way that brought personal benefit, but was never created for personal edification, and would eventually, however, in the assembly meeting, it was on the bottom of the visible gift lists, first being gifts of apostles, prophets, and teachers, and the last being tongues when you're talking about the leading and shaping and the visibility of the giftedness of various gifts in the church meeting. As the churches matured and spread, this gift would eventually fade. Now, Don picks up on this oikodome, which is, again, oikos, or family, house at the root. The key criteria, which he calls oikodome, is edification or community benefit. Here it receives even more emphasis than in Paul's dealing with the selfish attitudes by the Corinthians. Winter, which is a book that Steve really likes of these early church ones that I keep forgetting to introduce you to. The concept of building up is not found in pagan religious language. Edification was a unique term Paul coined for the Christian faith, which reflects the responsibility of individuals that individuals should assume for the welfare of others as a matter of religious obligation. This concept of building one another up and dissolving those strata differences and creating this whole, the secular world at that time didn't even have a word for it. It's such a foreign concept. While the focus is on correcting the chaos around speaking in tongues, which characterized the immaturity of the Corinthian churches, Paul gives us a complete set of guidelines for these gatherings. These guidelines appear to be for the large gathering of all the churches of Corinth, not for small gatherings of individual meetings in homes, which are usually around 12 adults. And you can see when he describes these, it's a much bigger gathering. It doesn't mean that the core principles don't apply in our home situations, because they have practiced the Lord's Supper in the small home situations. But I'm talking about this larger meeting that they retire to. Paul's guidelines for the larger meeting were this, that he gave to all of his churches in the network, he says, at the end of the chapter. The most important visible gift is in the Church of Churches meeting was the apostles, followed by the prophets, because they would do the assessing of prophecy and teaching during the meeting and shape the meeting. And again, I didn't put that passage in there. It's one of them that I'd chosen. I must have deleted it. But you can read it at the end of 12, and you can see it at the beginning of 14. The assembly meeting should be participatory. One person has a psalm, another has a teaching, another a revelation, another a tongue, another interpretation. Let everything be done for the general upbuilding. There's that word of edification of the community. Now, quickly look at three of these guidelines. The prophets should prophesy in an orderly manner, one at a time, and if something is fresh, one currently speaking should be quiet. And fourth, women should not prophesy in this larger context, but the teaching and authority of assessing that teaching should be done by men, as the social structure of the churches is that of a family of families. This is a difficult issue, and I'm going to come back to it in the lesson at the end here. And then 1 Corinthians 14, 26 to 28. So just those principles came from this section. So where does this leave us, my brothers, after dealing with the tongues thing? When you come together, one person has a psalm, another a teaching, another a revelation, another a tongue, another an interpretation. Let everything be done for the general upbuilding. If anyone speaks in a tongue, it should be by two or three at the most, each taking their turn. Each one of them should be put into plain speech. But if none of them can do that, let them be silent in the assembly and speak to themselves and to God. You see, what happens oftentimes, like Michael told his story of going into these churches, these small house churches in the village, in the slums, and leaders were coming together. By the way, he didn't mention that Ebi has built a system. He visited representatives of this, but he has over 2,200 leaders now trained with stories like what Michael told. And they each, in their plan, this four-year training, plant five churches. And his goal is 22,000 of these, which would be 100,000 house churches. And he's on pace, you know, for doing it. So you saw a slice. But what happens is when you go into those churches and they don't have the teaching, the kerygma, the didache, they don't have anything like the first principles, then they're all standing around jabbering with no content. Again and again and again with nothing there, creating these experiences. And they've all brought their own experience with them into the church and they never grow and they never get established. And it's unsustainable. So what Michael was describing that we're involved in doing is going into those situations and helping them get the teaching and begin to build on that rather than just these empty, ecstatic experiences. Steve's been particularly sensitive to this as we go in and out of the churches. He keeps saying again and again, when you get inside the churches, you realize that unless we get this kind of foundation in them, in fact, even then, some of them take the teaching of the first principles and don't transform their service as a result. Now, where are we going? What is going on here? Well, the revelation is not complete. It's unfolding. It came in many forms. And the range of this revelation coming to the gathered churches was in a psalm, teaching in a song, an unpacking the apostolic teaching, the Didache, a revelation, a theology and culture, major insight, a tongue, the gospel proclaimed, kerygma proclaimed in another language, and interpretation is the translation of that. And that's the little word for translation. As for prophets, let two or three speak, and the others evaluate what is said. If fresh revelation comes to someone sitting there, the first person should be silent. You can all prophesy one by one so that everyone can learn and everyone can be encouraged. The spirit of the prophets is under the control of the prophets, spirits of the prophets, since God is the God, not of chaos, but of peace. What's he talking about here? Well, first, he says, at the end of 12, there are apostles, and they gave the apostolic teaching and laid the foundation. Then came the prophets, where they do theology and culture on that teaching. Now, what do I mean by theology and culture on that teaching? Well, remember 1 Corinthians 7, where Paul says, this is my opinion, this is the commandment of the Lord, this is my opinion, I also think it would be better if you did this. He was counseling on the basis, guiding the church on the basis of that bedrock teaching, how to work things out in their culture, how to think about these issues in the numerous problems and cultural settings they're going to find themselves in. So the prophets are the ones, essentially, who were not coming up with new bedrock teaching. That was the apostolic teaching delivered to the churches. But the understanding it, its implications, doing theology and culture. So this, if you're facing these 25 problems in your marriages and you only got one marriage text, here's how you work it out. And all of that was part of this. But they also collectively needed to be affirmed by the prophets. In all the assemblies of God's people, the women should keep silent in the assemblies. They are not permitted to speak. They should remain in submission just as the law declares. If you want to understand something more, they should ask their own husbands at home when they get home. It is shameful, you see, for a woman to speak in the assembly. Do you suppose God's words began with you? Are you the only ones it has reached? What he seems to be taking place here is this. This could be referring to women prophetesses, to leaders or the prophets' wives, or to any women entering into the debate to validate the teaching of the meeting. Because remember, it says the prophets are to test this. It is unlikely that it refers to all public participation in the meeting, but to the debate validating the teaching that shapes the church of churches. Because when you're outside and the gospel is progressing, women had the gifts that were prophetesses. Women were very, very key in the progress of the gospel as a whole. When you bring it into the family of families, then we respect the household structure at that point. So leaders are men who do a good job in their own households. And all other men are responsible for their households, and the assembly is not to be turned into chaos. That's the logic of this. If anyone thinks they are a prophet or spiritual, they should acknowledge that what I write to you is the Lord's command. He's stepping up the heat a little. This isn't my opinion. If anyone disregards this, that person can be disregarded. So, my brothers and sisters, be eager to prophesy and don't forbid speaking in tongues. And everything should be done in a seemly fashion and in proper order. Now, that's the whole argument. So then what we do, and if you were doing your booklet when it's done, you would be asking about building unity through the community gathering. Why is the gathering of the whole church and church of churches so critical for our unity today? Everybody in our church of churches here gets the local small church because we know people, it's small, it's in a home, we have a meal rather together, and that's what's attractive to non-believers also as we bring them in. And most of you are getting the idea of a of a cluster, where we get together for three or four churches that cluster together periodically. It's a little harder to get the big picture of the meeting. But if we don't have the big picture where we gather together and where there's the bedrock of love and unity at the base in a meal together and the visibility of it and skillful leaders, apostles and prophets, shaping that conversation and teaching, and yet the spontaneous bringing of things together by all of the household heads within the community, you've got a phenomenal thing happening. And without that piece, everything fragments. That's why we've structured things the way that we've structured them. Why is the Lord's Supper so critical to that unity? What should it look like? How can we break the Western paradigm of the church service and reinstitute Paul's instruction to the churches? And how can we bring order to the community-wide gatherings of our churches while still leaving it open for the Spirit to work? Now, tremendous insight here. The significance of our larger gathering of churches is key to building the body and is key to our proclamation in the community. What have we done with the Lord's Supper? In the West, we made it individualistic, we made it mystical reflection, we've lost the true meaning and effect on building unity within the churches. Let me give you an example. I think we moved in the right direction with the idea of what we call a love feast, which is what the early church called it, evidently a bigger feast than just the smaller Lord's Supper in an individual home, but what we see here in 1 Corinthians 11 through 14. But I think we're still falling short of that, maybe even significantly short of it. Let's take the Easter Lord's Supper that's coming up. Now, most of you know I refer to it as the Lord's Breakfast because of how we do it culturally here. All the rest of them are in the evening. I can live with that adaptation, all right? But it's still small. Think about when we have our picnic, which is one of these, down in Des Moines, let's say. We're gathered together. We have a meal. It affects that. And I think generally, across the board, there's a pretty good understanding of all of us about the equality of every believer, regardless of where they're coming from. And that's embedded in the supper, and we got that down. But what do? We do a little bit of traditional music singing, which isn't all what they did. We might do a little bit of teaching, but you can't hear it. And even when we do something like the Easter thing, we do a short amount of singing, and we don't get into any kind of dialogue that has any kind of depth or any teaching that has depth or revelation that would come with it. Am I right? Now, I know what happens here, because the idea is, okay, well, we're going to go from 5 to 7:30 on our evening ones, but we got to get out of there because we got to get the kids to bed. And the way our culture is set up, and so we shorten it, and things become token, and we don't really have a good understanding of what was supposed to happen in that meeting after that supper when we retire. Now, it is what will instill in all of us the significance of being a church of churches. It's not just an Easter breakfast. It's not just a picnic. And we've shortened it. What I'd like to do, and this will create a big discussion, but I don't have to worry about the discussion because I'm on a plane at 6 a.m. in the morning, and I'm disappearing for 3 weeks, all right? And then I show back. I come back Saturday night right before Easter Sunday, okay? So I hope. Anyway, I'd like to try this once. I'd like to meet 8 to 10. Sorry, Des Moines people. You'll have to leave at 7:15. But, you know, 3 of my 4 flights, and you heard Michael's story, 3 of my 4 flights in and out of Africa from India to get the 2 groups in were red eyes. 2 of them would start, flew out at 3 o'clock. A lot of the people that would gather for their gatherings in places like India, as you're describing, might walk 5 hours as a family, be in a 4-hour meeting, and walk home. Now, I'm not saying... Well, what am I saying? Anyway, just think of this just as a proposal, all right? 8 to 10, we have the Lord's Supper. Culturally, around breakfast on Easter. We break bread, we enjoy a breakfast, we bring a song, a hymn, a spiritual song in the form of praise. We not be afraid, we just don't get up and just sing. We don't have to be afraid. We can't be afraid of doing things like Sean Houston did a while back, where he took Hank Williams' songs and his whole testimony and the theology of it and put it all together into an expression and a statement that had solid teaching into it. I heard quite a few comments. What are you doing that for? You can't do it. 10 to 12. 1 Corinthians 15, I'd like to take my next study for this time and do 1 Corinthians 15. It wouldn't be as long because it's just one chapter, but you think it's God's sovereignty that we wind up on Easter in 1 Corinthians 15, which is the great treatment of the